Three.
Cash.
You know the one. You buy one, you get one. Hey, I said, you buy one, you get one free. Right now, for every single window door that you buy, I'll give you another one. Absolutely
free cash.
I chose the name. See, we'd sign on Thursday and then the dryer would not come on the Friday, so often we'd be skint at the weekend. On Monday, the dryer would arrive. Happy Monday. That was the day for getting off your face. It's funny that, because we're going from strength to strength, and in the end we decided to go into the Enterprise allowance stage to keep off the doll, keep the doll off our back. Now we could officially operate as a bona fide band, about the pressure of worrying and annoying trips to the Dole office to sign on every other week. Unemployment is a guitar out in everyone. Reported a Channel 4 documentary from 1985. Large numbers of people seek to escape the boredom of the Dole by forming bands and playing music.
When people write about stuff about what I've done and TG and all the rest of it, Chris and Cozy and all those things, they always talk about, you know, the politics of the time and things. And I suppose it's interesting, but when you're right in the middle of it, you don't think of that, you're just getting on with life. Because a lot of the 70s and were like 3-day weeks and power cuts and coal shortages, and it was a really tough time. But when you're used to it being tough anyway, which it was once I left home, it was hand to mouth all the time, and power cuts weren't a big deal really in the great scheme of things. But then you've got to think about people reading it that are coming to it from a different era, sort of put it, you know, where it was, it's important really, because a lot of things I did that are in the diary were influenced by what was going on at the time.
Hello, this is Ruth Angel Edwards
and Adam Gallagher
with our second show in the series, Welfare to Artwork, Part 2.
On last month's show, we started looking into the history of benefits and other welfare policy in the UK and the complex and paradoxical relationship that it's had with Britain's artistic and cultural legacy.
We looked at bands like The Fall, who along with many others, received the Dole.
And it played a crucial part in supporting their songwriting, forming their experimental sound. And also we looked at the EAS, a proto-neoliberal piece of policy that aimed to get young people off the dole and into self-employment, encouraging an entrepreneurial attitude. It was in fact used by many, but...
An entrepreneurial attitude.
But was in fact used by many to fund the early stages of pioneering creative work they wouldn't be able to find support for elsewhere.
We also looked briefly at changes under Tony Blair's new Labour government, ideological and practical, of the country's attempted rebranding as Cool Britannia, where the Labour Party latched on to popular music at the time, and the creative industries, as they became known as, were now factored in as a valid part of the economy.
And the state now has a vested interest in cultural production, with things like Labour's New Deal for musicians. In this episode, we started to look a bit more deeply at the time, how this unique set of conditions led to an unprecedented burst of creative energy in an impoverished and tumultuous Britain under Tory rule.
And to think about what it was actually like living in the UK in the 70s and 80s as someone trying to make things.
Coming shortly, the Conservatives.
I can't bear Britain in decline. I just can't. We who either defeated or rescued half Europe, who kept half Europe free when otherwise it would be in chains. And look at us now.
The Thatcher government is a kind of an experiment.
in whether it will be possible in a democratic society that has gone as far as Britain has gone to change course in an orderly, effective way to set Britain on a new road. If the Thatcher government succeeds, it will be an example that will not be lost on the United States or the rest of the world.
No, we're totally Americanized.
Again, it's so, not something we've had to go and import. It's actually being flooded on us anyway. We've got no choice.
I think England's too American.
Yeah.
In the 1970s and 1980s, about a third of all male unemployed were young workers aged less than 24 years, whilst by the mid-1970s, one third of all unemployed men and two thirds of all unemployed women were under 24 years old. The implication was that the burden and solutions to unemployment were shifting to a new generation. The immediate reaction to the social situation, directed through creative channels, would become manifest through subcultures and popular modes of expression. The nihilistic rhythms of punk, although quickly commodified, were a spontaneous reaction from a section of the community who were capable of providing a response. A youthful demographic felt increasingly disconnected by social and economic forces, over which they had no control, connected through the common language of music and its ability to translate this dislocation. The punk scene was visible and varied, but interestingly, many were quick to adopt more electronic modes of expression. Early manifestations of bands such as the Human League and the Clock DVA, articulating their nonconformity through modernist forms, with a drum machine, sequencer, or Super 8 projector, frequently cheaper or more available than a guitar amp or drum kit. Access and affordability gave modernity an ironic appeal.
So that was taken from a section of Stephen Mallinder's 2007 thesis, Sheffield is Not Sexy, which gives an account of Sheffield at the time. Stephen Mallinder teaches on the Digital Music and Sound Art course at Brighton Uni and is the founding member of experimental 80s electronic band Cabaret Voltaire. And he'll be speaking to us on our next show in July.
Why can't we have some decent food?
Because we haven't got any bread.
Well, why don't we get some bread?
Because, Vivian, we haven't got any bread.
Okay. This has gone far enough. House meeting! Viv, wake up, Rick.
Rick! Wake up!
Forgotten youth just waste away, sniffing glue to face the day. Walking streets signing on, government schemes go on and on. It's no news. Round and round, I'm upside down. I try to get up, you kick me down. Vicious circle, there's no hope. Around my neck, you like a rope. Statisticians, politicians, you feed us crap. We've all caught up in a rat trap. Rigor mortis on the dole. Am I alive? I don't know. Punk was meant to be the voice of the Tower Block and the voice of the Dole Queue, and in reality most of them are not. The Bromley contingent came from nice middle-class Bromley. Joe Strummer's dad was a diplomat and he sang about White Riot and lived in a big house. There's nothing wrong with that, but oi was the reality of the punk mythology. Bands like the Upstarts from South Shields, everywhere was closing down and there was no jobs. In the places where the Cockney Rejects came from, it was harder and more aggressive. Gary Bushell.
You are, Rick. I can sense it.
I am not. I just don't see why it has to be me who gets a job.
Well, it can't be me. I lead an alternative lifestyle.
Alternative lifestyle? Ha! Your man's alternative is Channel 4!
All right, now why don't we look for a job in the paper? Vivian? I'm sorry about that bang. I just fired a gun.
Here we are. Situation's vacant, pages 7 to 13.
Much to my mum's and the Dole office's delight, I decided to get a job. The notes on my unemployment records make for some interesting reading. 18th of February 1970. Not very enthusiastic about work. Very modern dress, wearing long boots, old fur coat and black velvet and lace creation. Not at all suitable for office work in view of appearance. 6th of May 1970. Usually attends employment section with boyfriend who dresses most peculiarly. Still seeking clerical work, but appearance has deteriorated. Untidy and extremely modern clothing. Not fit for submission. Would reclassify, except for good GCSE O levels, and it would be a waste of a good education if this girl did factory work. 3rd of June 1970. Miss Newby is so changeable in appearance. Can look extremely attractive or dirty and shabby. Nice girl to talk to, and I think she is under the bad influence of her boyfriend, who is a freelance artist. He always attends with her, and they both live in a derelict house shared by several hippie-type characters.
That was Cozy Fanny Tutti, performance artist, writer and musician, best known for Bob and Gristle and Chris and Cozy. That was an excerpt from her book, Art, Sex and Music.
coup actions were now being referred to as decoum positions, and our attentions were being directed to Ferran's Art Gallery, where we set up our Bible and beach umbrella outside and gave speeches with our different coum members, dressed as the alien brain, in a gold tinsel dress gas mask and accompanied by varying characters. We'd take the pram around town, sometimes with Jen in it as a baby, being pushed by pregnant Mrs. Asquith, Biggles. The pram was slowly being transformed into the sculpture Wagon Train, which was later exhibited in the Ferran's Art Gallery Winter Show. That was all very well, but the pram was my only means of transporting our bags of dirty washing to the laundrette, which was a good 4 mile walk from Prince Street. It was bad enough that only I ever did that trip on my own, save for the times Fizzy came to help me. I could just about get away with drawing too much attention when it looked like any old pram, but a gold pram with all kinds of odds and ends stuck to it, as Jen gradually worked it into a sculpture, meant that I dreaded that laundrette trip more than ever. And I was also pissed off that the so-called radical thinkers and supporters of liberation, like Jen, Greg and the others, couldn't see that they had assumed my role as woman to be the washer, cook and cleaner, in addition to everything else I did within Coombe. When it came to sharing domestic work, the quality of the sexes seemed to escape them.
Yeah, so that was Sister George, influential queercore band. They're from London as well, and they made this album. The album's called Drag King, while they were on the Dole as well. So, as we said earlier, we were looking for a conclusive list, a more comprehensive list of people that were on the EAS, but also like loads of music or art that was made on the Dole.
So one thing that we did read in an Angela McRobbie essay was that there is no comprehensive list of all the reciprocants of the EAS scheme. But we've looked around and tried to find some more anecdotal evidence in interviews and stuff like that. So we've got...
So in the EAS, Tricky was on it when he was doing his first album. Portishead, Jeff Barry actually met Beth Gibbons in an EAS induction day. The record companies that were started by, obviously from before, Alan McGee's Creation Records, also Sarah Records, which came out of the Bristol fanzine scene. That was headed up by Claire Wood and Matt Hine. Also Viz Magazine and Superdry. Superdry, the clothing brand, now one of the most successful British businesses. And in Manchester, Affleck's Palace, which provided all the clothes and record shops in the establishment of Manchester. How do you describe Affleck's Palace? Also on it were artist Jeremy Deller, who won the Turner Prize, obviously, and Chase Yemin. Two more bonus mentions. I like Rick Astley was on it before he got scouted by Pete Waterman. And Adamski, he used his money to buy his first keyboard.
Didn't he go, he went to Ibiza with his, he took the keyboard to Ibiza or something?
Yeah, that's how the story goes.
And then just some of the general people got the doll while they were writing some music that became really important. So Vince Clarke, apparently that's not his real name.
No, his real name's actually Vincent John Martin.
That's Vince Clarke from Depeche Mode and Yazoo and my favourite band in the whole world, Erasure. So obviously UB40 were definitely on the doll. The band name UB40 comes from a doll form. Also the Specials, the Stone Roses,
Oasis, the Jesus and Mary Chain, and Super Furry Animal, Jarvis Cocker with Pulp, The Slit. Mick Jones went over to enlist Joe Strummer in the Doll Q. Mythology, well no, that's a true story.
Mentioned this a little bit on the last show, but a lot of bands that came out of Liverpool in the 80s, so Echo and the Bunnymen, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Big in Japan.
And also in the Doll were My Bloody Valentine and the Manic Street Preachers' first single, that was also made on the Doll. And Cabaret Voltaire's first album, Mix Up, Doll Money.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess what we gathered from this is that for a long period of time, it seemed that going on the Doll was kind of what you did if you wanted to, if you wanted to pursue music.
I think people expect, when they think it's a band, they expect automatically they can identify with the people on stage and look up to them and think they're good, you know, good people or something. But I think it's important that we manipulate these roles and that we're not always just the good guys, you know, that we take a role and really push people's understanding and make them think about the situation of a concert, how they're consuming this culture, how they're passive, how they're being dictated to. Because I think any performance by any group is part of a political structure, and it holds up the whole system. In other words, the whole industry and record companies and everything.
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's like, it just shows like the kind of emancipate, like liberation, but also the problematizing of like culture slowly changing. And like these being quite radical men, people in comma, but still being men. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why I quite like that quote. And it's also this idea of like the everyday being like remorphed and turned into art, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, as is with like Merlin that lot and Cabaret Voltaire, they, like white noise was becoming music, you know, or could be used as material for music, as could the pram. So that's why I thought it would be quite a good interlocutor.
The group would become infamous in Hull for a piece of conceptual art known as the wagon train.
It was my usual pram for popping for laundrette, something as mundane as that, you know. And then gradually it got decorated up and became a wagon train with a hooped hood on it, which was like fluorescent pink polythene. And it was sprayed gold and had gold frying pans and all kinds of objects hanging from it. The wagon train ended up as being an exhibit in the Ferrans Art Gallery, which was an ironic statement for us because we were so anti-establishment art and art institutions. But that appealed to us. That's what Coombe was all about. Infiltrating, contradicting, doing the unexpected.
Doctor Who! Hey! It's artist Doctor Who! poverty, minimum wage by the government, when said to 95, you know. But, you know, that's how they designed it long ago, not just now. Generation has passed, you know. So we this generation, we have to do something about something. Let's confront these people. It's about time. Brother, food for the radio. Well,
a posse of 3 million on the dump.
At this point in the show, I wanted to bring up two short quotes that I think hint at the kind of nuance or the novelty that was definitely like present in that time, in terms of experimentation and improvisation, working with or against culture. The hippies' rejection of and lack of engagement with the world at large had led to complete introversion and no strategies of passage from one to the other. The situation regarding punk was slightly different, in that its DIY ideology apparently became transformed by Thatcher's policies into enterprise culture. For all of these reasons, British pop was gradually accused of transforming itself into gimmickry, demolishing boundaries between serious songwriting and frivolous sampling, and deconstructing the identity of pop as incomprehensible to the canons of rock culture. Seeing pop through the inverted commas of postmodernism was a way of attacking the strengthened capitalist forces of the globalised music industry of the Thatcher years, but at the same time, this ambiguity seemed to suggest that pop was thoroughly postmodernised, but also yearning for its lost identity. In terms of pop Englishness, new forms of non-articulated Englishness evolved in response. This was later happening in relation to dance culture and their non-articulated scenes, attitudes and movements expressing Englishness by the lifestyles they encompass and the nomadic nature of modern English culture.
We sat in the garden outside where we live at the church and spoke to our neighbours, artist and musician Alana Curry from 80s pop sensation The Thompson Twins, who were part of what was described as the second British invasion phenomenon, where British music acts received massive global success, and Jimmy Courtney from subversive music industry Pranksters and influential acid house and early chill out guys, the KLF, to find out what it was actually like living in London on the dole as a creative person in the 70s and 80s, and to reflect on some of the differences between then and now.
Maybe this is a new window onto a new kind of utopian sort of dole world.
Well, it sounded like that when we read about the 80s, it sounded like a more utopian dole world.
Well, it was easy then because there were so many squats, so you didn't need that much money.
So when did you sign on first?
About 1975.
What, when you first came to London?
No, when I left school. Oh, no, that would be 73.
So as soon as you left school, you signed on?
Yes, straight away. No. That's what everybody
did.
Did
your mum say to you, get down the dole office then?
Yeah, they were like, you might as well just go and get the money because it's free money, basically. Oh. But there wasn't really a culture of looking for a job in the sort of group of friends like I had.
Yeah.
Everybody was just like lying around, getting stoned.
Well, I was from New Zealand, so when I was 18, I think, I got a letter, an actual physical letter from a friend who had already come to London. She said, just come over, there's free houses and free money from the government, it's great. So I came over, you know, and landed here when I was 19. and went to the Brixton Dole office pretty much the week I got here. And, you know, told them, I think I told them I'd just arrived and I was looking for a job. There was this idea that I'd find a job. And then you were just in the register. And from then on, you know, every 2 weeks, I think you went to the post office and you just picked up your gyro and cashed it in. And off you went and lived a nice little life, you know, and then you could be in bands and you could do other things. Everybody had jobs as well. So there was lots of cash in hand jobs going on. And if you can get a gig, you know, a paid gig, you wouldn't sign off. You did, though, because you used to get quite a lot of money from your royalties, didn't you? Quite early
on. But I only had to sign off the week that the royalty check arrived, technically. So I had to sign off that week, spend all the royalties all in one go, and then sign on again the following week and carry on as normal.
I remember that. He used to get a royalty check every quarter. I remember it was the most amount of money I'd ever seen anybody get. It was like about $2,000, wasn't it? And you would buy motorbikes or...
Usually some kind of transportation.
We'd have big parties all the beer would be on Jimmy and it was all really exciting and then you'd have none.
When I first met you, you actually had a job.
Yes, I did. I got myself a proper job.
Quite unusual to meet somebody who had an actual job.
Yeah, I did go through a little phase after a couple of years of that sort of living like that. I decided I needed a proper job. So I got a job at an agency and didn't sign on. So that was just, you know, again, you could work 3 or 4 days a week and then do bands at night and gigs, whatever. So we used to just treat the dole like, I suppose like now you treat an arts council or a uni grant.
Yeah.
You know.
But nobody seemed to eat anything in those days either, so you didn't have to buy food.
Yeah, you just had to buy fags.
Fags.
We smoked endlessly and ate those horrible pork pies from the shop that were wrapped up in cellophane.
Yeah.
And then you'd buy some weed or something. That was it, you know. Mm. And we were squatting, so there was no rent. Yeah. And then sometimes if you got a job waitressing or doing some of those sort of gigs, of course you'd get the food from the restaurant or whatever, and that would feed everybody in
there. It was definitely much cheaper
street.
To live, I'd say, than it is now.
So I lived in a street called Lilyshell Road, which is up in Clapham Old Town. And there were those little cottages, two-down cottages.
Mm.
And there were about, I think, 12 households in the street. So we more or less had the whole of one end of the street.
It was all squats?
All squats. So it was a really good community. And I was actually given I didn't even have to break in. I was given the key by the woman who got it from the tenant who moved out. Because a lot of the tenants were really cross at having to be moved out. And then the council just boarded up the houses and did absolutely nothing with them. And then people who were very anti-squatting, like various sort of very right-wing neighbours, would come round and pour concrete down the toilets and pull the wiring out and wreck the whole place so you couldn't squat them. So some of them were
so they tried to get there first kind of thing?
Yeah, to wreck them so they because they didn't want these ne'er-do-well, horrible little kids coming into their neighbourhood, you know. So there were always a few of those in the neighbourhood. So I had this really great house to myself, you know, and my currency was I had the bath.
Amazing.
The bath with out the back in a lean-to, and I had this huge gas boiler that was really, really dangerous. But it was great, so everybody would come to my house for the bath, you know, and that was good, yeah. So we did that. I was like signing on for a good, I think I did it for about 3 years of living like that, signing on. Then I got a proper job. Then I went back to signing on again. And then I got in a band, you know.
Mm.
And then that was it.
So did you both live mainly around Brixton then?
Yeah, Brixton, Stockwell, Clapham, all around Lambeth, really.
Mm. And there was very big networks, so everybody knew everybody else.
Yeah.
And there were lots of different groups, and news would travel rapidly and people helped each other. I mean, it was great. It was a really good sort of communal collective way of living, and there were lots of parties, you know. It was really good fun, really, wasn't it?
But I guess there were so many people doing it.
Yeah,
that's another thing that doesn't seem to be happening now. It was pretty unheard of to carry on living with your parents when you were about 17 years old. If you were, then people were like something than we had to pay. But it was possible because you could live cheap. That's what it's difficult now.
And it was also, you could stay there long enough. And you knew you could stay there long enough that, there were occasional evictions. There were sort of mad attempts at evictions. Everybody would run around there and, stop people being evicted. But, I mean, word got round that pretty much they were solid communities. I was in that one, 6 years, I think, in the same house. So it meant you could build up a lifestyle. You could do other things. The dole money gave you loads of freedom to get bands together, to do things, to create communities and really work on what it was that you did, and squats, you could rehearse bands, there was nowhere else, you just stick mattresses up and around the walls and egg cartons, get amps out, there was nobody to tell you to shut up, it was great.
There's a really good quote from the test department crew, and they were just like, we just go to the Docklands and just squat a massive building, that would be our drum studio. They'd just be playing those insane drums.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. And like every band had one.
I mean, the London that we know now has been so gentrified. I mean, people have got a lot more stuff, their houses are a lot smarter, buildings. I mean, in 1977, when I came to London, there were bomb sites everywhere. Things were filthy. It was black. You had no money. There was, you had like two pairs of trousers and one sweatshirt. There wasn't stuff. There just wasn't. You didn't have lots of stuff. You didn't have lots of food. You didn't have lots of anything. It was pretty, pretty raw and pretty basic time. And most people lived like that, It was poor. And there was a lot of talk of the war, and the evidence of the war was still there as well. So I think expectations weren't that huge. The record company used to send you limousines. I mean, it had no idea that actually you were paying for the limousines in the long run anyway. But they would send them, and it was so novel to pull up a limousine pulling up, take you to do Top of the Pops or something, outside the squat. And it was saying everybody would be in the limo, going once around the block or twice around the block just for the fun of driving in the limo. But yeah, so that got really embarrassing. I mean, why are you in the squat? The co-op, they hounded you out. I went and lived in a hotel instead after that. And it was really sad because I'd lived in that house a long time and that was my community.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think you made the best work in that place. The first and second album was from that place. And it's like, they were the community, they were the people. And then, you start that whole other road of weird pop star life where you're completely disattached and disassociated from things. It really does mess you up.
It just sounds like everyone was in it together. And,
yeah.
Or maybe it wasn't.
Well, there were lots of squatters around. I mean, there must have been thousands. 10,000.
Wow.
And lots of whole streets were squatted, especially around Brixton. But then we only really knew about the South London scene, but it was even bigger in
there. Yeah, there were Hampstead, Camden.
Yeah.
There were loads of those ones.
Yeah.
But you didn't know everybody in all the other ones. You sort of just, we were Brixton, Stockport, Clapham. Mm. That was our lot.
There was still a North London
South
thing.
South London
there.
Divide.
People from the North didn't like him. That was kind of weird because, you have a meeting, you say, I want to rewire my house, and then Lambeth Council would put the money into your bank account and you could
have a party.
Basically do what you liked with it because nobody was checking up on anything. So that was sort of the end of squatting, really, on a big scale.
Yeah.
And co-ops.
I think that's the co-op that our house is part of. Is one of the oldest co-ops, and I think it's from that era.
Early 80s.
Nice housing co-op.
Yeah.
But all the convoy and all that, that was all happening. And Thatcher was like, that madness. Just convoying around, being completely lawless. It was all during her reign.
Is it a rain? What do you call it? I mean, it was all from the era of Margaret Thatcher as well.
Yeah.
So looking back on that, it was quite an anarchic time. But you've got Margaret Thatcher in charge, you'd think that it would be very difficult to do anything. But in fact, it was really free and easy compared to what things are like now.
However you can describe it, it's like the in-between space. Like, because everything's been so corporatised and capitalised in London...
Yeah, but that could change, man.
It's a weird accidental moment where there was actually a lot of freedom for people as well, but against what was maybe intended, or I don't know.
It was very clear who the enemy were. But then I remember when Tony Blair got came in, that was the first time I ever voted when he came in. And I actually liked him. And I was like, this is really weird. That you actually would like the Prime Minister, because traditionally they'd usually been conservative and like sort of been against them, you know. So when you're against the government, that can give you quite a lot of energy to do the thing that you're doing, I guess.
Yeah, and it unites people.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were no Thatcher-loving squatters as far as
I
knew.
No, there weren't any, were there? No.
And they would have been burnt at the stake.
Yeah.
You're angry and you wanted to confront things a lot. That's why you made work, you know, and you wanted to challenge people's ideas and you wanted to present visual things in ways that they hadn't seen before. You know, the dialogue was constantly wanting to be there.
Yeah, but there was an argument that because we had all this time and space that you could rehearse your band or write songs. And it wasn't really costing you anything. I mean, it was nice to be able to rehearse at home and have that time, but I mean, I think a lot of time got wasted. I mean, I spent about 20 years trying to get my band to be happening, but
to get out of bed first.
Out of bed, get on the road, and that's a long time, and with nothing going on.
Now everything's documented, so loads of new emerging subcultures or any countercultural movements are always, not always, but like so often, people are still using WhatsApp and like Instagram and all these things where they can be observed. Why are people so complacent using all these platforms? Maybe in the 70s and 80s, the government was so out of touch with everything, so it could happen under their noses or something, even in London.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's like the idea of actually coming offline or sort of not using technology is such a kind of...
Yeah, but there was virtually no surveillance back then, as far as I can see. I guess you could get away with much more.
Yeah, we were not observed, and we were not observing ourselves either. So we weren't documenting ourselves and what we were doing. We were sort of just doing it and acting on the moment and making things up as we went along. Improvising and music was a massive thing in the late 70s for me anyway, you know, as how I got into being in bands and stuff. And it was really, really exciting. But there was no, there was no you watching yourself or watching other people. It was just shut up and get on with it and, you know... Nobody sort of held everybody to account. It was like you learnt as you went along. Fanzines were a big thing. Word of mouth was a huge thing. People would bang on people's doors to tell them what was going on down the road. That's how I heard about the Brixton riots, you know. It wasn't from the paper or TV. I don't think we didn't have a TV, you know, or radio or something. It was just somebody banging on the door saying things are going off in Brixton, and everybody just grabbed coats and ran down there, you know, to see what was going on.
Yeah, but because everything's documented now, and everything you do or say is sort of there forever for everybody to see and dissect.
Yeah, so people are so self-conscious.
That wasn't the case before. You could sort of do something and it would sort of disappear.
Yeah.
Or wouldn't really exist after it had finished. So that's a bit weird about the internet thing.
But this is this world we're moving to, highly digitized world.
This interview that we're doing now will last for 1,000 years. But if it was broadcast on, you know, a pirate radio station, it would just be gone.
Totally.
You know.
Totally. And there would be, unless someone was recording it on a little tape or something, and you wouldn't even know.
With the guy with the shiny shoes.
Yes, him.
I guess, like, technology is, like you were saying, Alana, it's just, like, atomised loads of people at the moment. It's, like, a lot of people are, like... I don't think there's, like, less... I think there might even be more people making things, but making them in less communal ways, maybe. Like, online, specifically by themselves, presenting, like, their own... I don't know, like, imaginary world.
For kids now, it must seem really, really strange how you could achieve anything in the world without the internet.
I mean, I've been thinking about that recently because, it's that whole digital world, the material, visceral world, you know. And this, the whole virus has just shown that up to be even more so and is pushing it more in that direction of isolated people who have imaginary worlds, you know, they have imaginary lives online.
So at this point in the interview, something weird but kind of perfect happened, which was that the SD card filled up on the dictaphone, meaning that what Alana was leading onto was lost and we'll never actually have a document of it. So you're just going to have to imagine what we ended up talking about after this point.
This brings us to the end of the show.
Remember, we're still collecting anecdotal stuff, suggestions of things to read, and obviously we're still trying to compile a list of interesting, influential stuff that's being produced while on the dole or on benefits. So you can get in touch at info@freecash.zone, all lowercase.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the next show is going to be about. We've got Stephen Malander, an interview with him, but we'll also just probably begin to look more closely at the late 80s transitioning to the 90s up until the early noughties. I know, disemboweling Tony Blair. See you next time.
Bye.
Sit down. Take the weight off your feet.
What do you mean, sit down? There aren't any chairs.
Yeah, and all the towels have been burnt.
Oh, no. We've got to buy some furniture for Vivian, quickly. We can't. We haven't got any money.
Oh, no.
Vivian's baby will be a pauper. Oliver Twist, Jeffrey Dickens, back to Victorian values. I hope you're satisfied, Thatcher.
So you can listen to this and our previous show at montezpressradio.com. And also, if you're into it, you can check out other radio stuff that we do at our website, which is www.freecash.zone.